Jerry Buchholz is the Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA and back in the studio to talk about some of the successes and challenges of dealing with human resources in the federal government. Congratulations again on the great ratings in the Best Places to Work survey. I imagine you're probably sick of hearing about that and talking about it right now, but I do want to ask you two things about that to start. What did you learn besides about your success when you dug down into the numbers? What did you see there that was actionable in your view?
Well, I think one of the most important things that we learned was that you really can't just look at your overall agency scores. When you dig really down deep into our numbers, we pretty much use the whole range of the rating scale. We have certainly some of the highest scoring sub-organizations in the federal government, and we receive a lot of recognition for those as well. But we also have some of the lowest scoring organizations in the federal government. And so we've decided to take a really targeted approach at addressing some of those issues and doing a much more tailored, specific, positive, proactive intervention style approach with those organizations that are clearly asking for help.
That kind of takes me to the other question I wanted to ask you about the best places to work, which is, what's the dark side? Not everything is rosy in every scenario. So what did you see there that made you say, wow, that's not good and that's something we need to work on?
We've been focusing for years on first-line supervisors because we really believe that's the key to the whole thing. Because it's those first-line supervisors through their day-to-day hiring decisions, promotion, training, awards, work assignments, coaching, etc., that transform your organization. Their individual decisions roll up to transformation, keep you where you are, or can even set you back. Mm-hmm. And when we looked really deep into the data, that's what we discovered, that we have generally some of the best supervisors on the planet, literally. But there are pockets where we have supervisors that are really struggling and the employees are feeling that. And so that's what we're going to really work on, is getting in there and helping those supervisors be the best supervisors they can be for the people that they're leading.
Is that the kind of thing that your colleagues come to you with and say, how did you do X to get to the level of success that you had?
Sometimes some people come and are thinking more deeply about what it is that they want to do. But my observation is that people are still very much looking at very broad brush things. And I think you can only accomplish so much if you're looking very broadly across your organization, because as I said, all those decisions are happening about people at the local level. Mm-hmm. And so what I would really encourage federal agencies to do is look deeper and deeper and deeper into their organizations. Learn things from their subordinate organizations that are doing really, really well, and see if they can't take those same things that are already appropriate for their work cycle and culture and use them to assist those organizations that may be having a harder time.
And that fits with the narrative that I hear on an ongoing basis about success. And of course, the point is not to be successful in the numbers. The point is to be a great place to work. And
exactly.
I think that might get lost in this conversation sometimes. But the success is in the little things and doing a lot of them over a period of time and not in trying to do a quick turnaround. It sounds like that's the strategy that you're pursuing, is here are the one or two or three priorities that we're going to set to move forward, and then we'll see where we are, we'll reassess, and continue to move forward. Am I reading that right?
You are, and that's exactly right. That's great advice to any employer, not just in the federal government. And you really do have to work on what's important for your culture. And, you know, nobody loves badges and prizes more than me, and I freely admit that. However, what is really deeply important to me is that every person who comes to work at NASA has an invigorating, exciting, and interesting work experience every single day. And that's what we're working on. And if that means we win a prize, that's great. If that means that somebody else overtakes us and they get a prize, I will be standing in the front row cheering for them for that wonderful accomplishment. So we're not really teaching to the test or trying to win awards and prizes and recognition. We really are trying to make the individual experience of every one of our employees a really meaningful and valuable experience every day.
Gary Buchholz is the Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA and my guest in the executive suite. You talked about data a moment ago, and I wonder what kind of data you have as we go through the data revolution and agencies now have 50 billion pieces of data on everything. Mm-hmm. What data do you use in the overall task of shaping your workforce on an ongoing basis?
We look at a lot of different things. We do a lot of data analysis about our workforce as we build our budget. I think that's one of the more interesting things that we do that I don't see a lot of other federal agencies do. What we figure is that when you are out building your budget, so like right now we're working on 17, that's the period that you have known work. And you can take that known work and compare it against your current workforce and assess whether you have deltas or surpluses. And then that gives you 2 years to figure out how do you adjust the composition of your workforce in order to make sure that on the first day of that new budget period, you already have the people in place to get the work done that you need to get done. Mm-hmm. So that's one kind of workforce planning. Another kind of workforce planning is to look far past where data would take you. I call it past where the sidewalk ends. And then you get into sort of the prognostication, the estimation about what the world of work is going to be. And you can make predictions based on, you know, a couple of dimensions, like big, small, more technical, less technical. Just like you can predict on climate, hot, cold, wet, dry, which is what the climate scientists do.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at it really long term in that way, you can start to shape your workforce today for the workforce that you're going to need 30 years from now. But data will only take you so far, and you really have to be willing to step off the end of the sidewalk and go down a path that's not paved and not known in mm-hmm. order to be able to do that.
Do you have anything as formal or as calculated as like actuarial tables or anything like that, or do you not take it to quite that level?
Well, I wouldn't call them actuarial tables, but I think every agency has a cadence, a rhythm, mm-hmm. a pattern that becomes known to them as they look at data over time. So as we look at our, for example, our attrition data, or I think what you're referring to is retirement data.
Yeah.
We know that our employees rarely, if ever, retire when they are first eligible. The decision to retire is a very personal one. People make it for any number of reasons, including personal reasons. And so we know that our employees will stay past the first eligibility date of the retirement. Most of them will stay until they are approaching age 60. But by the time they're age 62, most of them who are eligible to retire will have departed from the workforce. And we look at these patterns every year, and we find that they are substantially similar. Whether the numbers shift, the pattern is substantially similar year after year after year. And that's what allows us to sort of predict where we're going, what numbers in a big, you know, in big bins are we going to be hiring, and how many people can we estimate are going to stay and going to go. There are also big differences. Engineers retire, I think, a little younger than PhD scientists, who may stay well into their 70s. So, you know, you have to understand your workforce. You have to understand the work culture that they're working in, and that there may be multiple cultures inside your organization that are having an impact.
Have any of those cultures changed over the past half decade? Decade to decade that have required you to rethink how you're shaping your strategy?
I think they have. Certainly with the end of the shuttle program and the shift in the focus in the agency, that was a worldwide event.
Yeah.
That impacted space exploration around the globe. And so there was a definite shift there. We went from the ideal being launching and landing the orbiter successfully 135 times in a row, returning the crew safely, to a different mission of using other people to travel to low Earth orbit in the Russian Space Agency, and also commercial enterprises, so that then we could focus our attention on taking human beings beyond low Earth orbit, past the moon and on to Mars. And that shift in focus created a much better relationship, not that it wasn't good before, but a good strong relationship between the science component of agency and the human exploration component of agency. In in a way, in a partnership way that I think is really exciting and new. So there have definitely been shifts for us. I also think generally in terms of federal government employment, the shift from the workforce being predominantly covered by CSRS retirement to the workforce being predominantly covered by FERS, people in those two retirement systems are making different choices about when they depart and why they depart. And I think we're seeing those shifts show up now as well.
I want to talk about some of those later on in our conversation, but I'm fascinated by this change essentially in the business model of NASA and the potential dominoes that might fall there. Have you detected or seen manifest different skill sets required in your acquisition teams or in your contract analysis teams or any of that because you're now interacting a lot more with commercial space providers? It's a lot different than I imagine it was in the past. Is that making your workforce needs different?
It is different. And NASA has always been a part of a tri-sector enterprise between the federal government, the commercial sector, and academia. I think what's different now is we are very, very actively a part of creating a whole new industry in the U.S. economy for space exploration. So we work with Orbital and we work with SpaceX and we work with a variety of different companies who are creating a whole new industry in the United States with really, really good paying jobs, that it's really forward looking. And we're creating a business model for research in low gravity, zero gravity, that we hope will result in corporations, pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, using these industries that we're helping create to just, you know, create great jobs and contribute to the economy. And I think that is different. And I think that it's different even than it was during the Apollo era, because the Apollo era was a destination. Mm-hmm. And we used the commercial sector to go to that destination. But it was a slightly different flavor than what we have now, because now we're not looking so much at the specific destination, a particular point on Mars that we want to go to, but rather having the capability to go as far as we can go and wherever we want to go.
Well, and I think there was a different, there seems to me conceptually to be a different view of it, because President Kennedy set a very specific goal. We want to be on the moon by the end of this decade, where I'm not sure we even are able to say we want to be on Mars by a particular time, because we may not know what we don't know yet. And that's, of course, what your scientists and some of the other folks that you have at your organization are working on. But maybe that's the difference, that we're not exactly even sure what our time frame or ultimate goal for the destination is.
So the best way I've heard this described, which really resonated with me, is, you know, when I think about it, where do I drive my car? I drive my car to the grocery store and I drive my car to work. And generally, that's where I drive my car. But when I go to buy a car, I don't buy a car that will only drive to the grocery store and to where I work. Mm-hmm. I drive a car that can go 300 miles on a tank of gas, and then I look inside that circle and see, where can I go? And it's that same kind of idea. We're creating a capability to go to wherever we decide we want or need to go. And it's a fundamental philosophical difference that makes you make different choices, which gets back to your original question of, is our workforce slightly different? Yeah. Are we making different kinds of choices? And I think the answer to that question is yes.
And you've talked about those a little bit, but let's explore that a little more, because you're not planning your workforce for 2015. Well, you are, but you're not just planning your workforce for 2015. No. You're planning it for 2020, 2030, and 2050. Mm-hmm. And so I imagine that trying to understand at least, not just how that business model looks today, but how it might look at each of those landmarks in the future is a critical part of those decisions that you're making.
Absolutely. And those are the conversations that we have in our Strategic Management Council, that our Executive Council has in the agency, always being forward-looking, forward-leaning, reaching farther.
Is it your sense, though, that that's dramatically different than it should be at other agencies that maybe aren't trying to go to Mars? I mean, I wonder if the idea that you're thinking that far ahead is or should be unique to a scientific and space agency like NASA, or if you would advise your peers at other agencies to be thinking the same way if they're not.
I would. You know, it's funny because everyone always looks at me and says, oh, well, you're NASA. And I'm like, well, you know, wait, because everyone is their own little NASA in their own community. And everyone has their Mars, right? The big thing that they're working for, their, you know, kind of squishy, soft, long-term goal that they're really trying to achieve. And it might be earth-shattering, or it might be really, really important to a smaller number of people. But everyone has that. And I think that thinking, oh, well, we're not like that is, that's kind of self-defeating. So I always encourage people to really think hard about, you know, who they are, where they're going, what they want to accomplish, and be open and optimistic about that in their discussions and their deliberations, and to think as far ahead as they possibly can about the people that they're going to need to help get them there.
Jerry Buchholz is the Chief Human Capital Officer at NASA. You mentioned SIRS and FERS a couple of minutes ago, and my notes say that next January 2016, the first round of FERS employees will be eligible to retire. And you did talk that not everybody retires, of course, when as soon as they're eligible to, but we may start to see folks take advantage of the FERS decision-making process. What does that look like in your mind a year from now? How will the individuals that make those decisions make them differently, do you think? And how will that force you or enable you to change the way that you look at how you're going to shape your workforce for the next several years?
So I mentioned next January in particular because individuals that were hired by the federal government shortly after they graduated from college turn 56 and have more than 30 years of service beginning next January. I know this because I'm one of them. So I think you're going to see a different kind of retirement profile going forward. Certainly, the economy has a great role to play in this. We have the opportunity as federal government employees to retire very, very young. You know, generally, I think out there in the world of work, 62 or 65 is considered the age that you retire. And so people who are 56 and are fully eligible to retire from the federal government have a decision to make. Are they going to complete their career with the federal government and continue to work until they decide that they are not going to work anymore? Or are they going to depart the federal government and go to work in the private sector where they still have 10 years that they can work and earn a separate retirement and do something completely different or even related to the work that they did while they are in the federal government? And it's that choice that I think is going to result in a different profile. CSRS employees have had this for a while, but post-retirement employment is not impacted the way under CSRS, the way it is under FERS. So it'll be interesting to see what choices people make. In my experience, people who work for the federal government have a deep belief in the mission that they do, in the work that they do. They do not need to go to the private sector in order to find value in their day-to-day work life. They enjoy the people that they work with. They really like their first-line supervisors. So it's really a tough choice. Do I finish out my work life in the federal government or do I try something somewhere else?
I'm starting to hear a lot more of that line of thinking from you and your colleagues in the government, in HR in the government, because in addition to that, employees have a good benefits package. They've been in FEHBP for however many years, so they're likely pretty healthy as they can be because they've had access to good health care over the years. There are far more incentives, it seems to me, to stay if you like what you're doing and you feel like you're being well taken care of despite the pay freezes and all that stuff than there are to leave at this point in time.
It is, I think, a tough choice for everyone. I do think that the choice that people really are making is not so much do I stop working altogether, but on the day that they will pay me to stay home, do I choose to come in?
How macro or micro do you think that you and your colleagues should look at the economy for cues as to what some of those folks might do or might not do?
I think more on a macro level, although I think you do have to look locally as well. And there are plenty of places, certainly there are plenty of NASA centers that where NASA is the only employer. So, you know, someone leaving and going to work for someone else means moving. So you have to look at the local. I don't see a lot of people completely you know, pulling up stakes and moving to other parts of the country for employment. So here in DC, where there are any number of choices for people, you might see more of that pattern of retire and then go to work for somebody else. But, you know, when you're talking about the Mojave Desert, probably not so much.
Yeah. What is the buzz in the HR community that you're hearing right now? What are you and your peers talking about that may not be getting a lot of coverage on a lot of people's radar screens?
Some of the things that I hear my colleagues talk about are, you know, some of the things, some of the reactions that we see to news events involving the federal workforce. Does the sum total of that create an indicator, a leading indicator, that we are on the precipice of big transformation of federal employment, similar to the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978? So far, I don't really see signs of that, but it may be early days yet. I think we are ready for that kind of transformation, and I do think that some really smart people are going to have to dig in hard and start thinking about, you know, what does the digital environment, the crowd environment mean for the rule sets that we have? Yes, we have automated systems, but essentially we've automated the thumbtacking of a piece of paper onto a cork bulletin board. And so if you really step all the way back and say, what does public service at the federal level in the United States look like 20 years from now, that's the conversation that I would like to see have happen, as opposed to the reacting to individual precipitous events.
That's a great place to leave it. And we'll continue that thought next time we get together. Jerry, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.